The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Nancy Spain, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norton, and Frank Muir. Round one attempts to test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meanings of these words approximately right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, the meaning of the word hebetude, H-E-B-E-T-U-D-E, hebetude.
Hebetude?
Hebetude, yes, it is. Prunes and prism sort of word.
Hebetude, I'm not in the hebetude. hebetude, stupidity.
You're absolutely right, it's stupidity, well done. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, what is a scut? S-C-U-T, scut.
Scut.
It's either a rabbit's tail, or it's what happens to a suggestive remark that is made on this recording.
Well done. You're dead right, Dennis. I was afraid you were going to say it was the opposite to a girl guide, but never mind. It can be the short tail of a hare or a rabbit or a deer or any animal which has not as much tail as it otherwise might have. Nancy Spade, what is a mezzanine?
It's in between the ground floor and the first floor.
Well, that might be almost anything.
What you have on a birthday cake, isn't it? Just underneath the icing.
But I still want to know what it is. You've described its location.
It's a floor.
That's fair enough, all right. It's a rather low browed story between two higher ones, and Nancy, quite right, it says normally between the ground and the first floors. Oops. 2 marks. Thank me, what's the meaning of Herbie? H-E-R-B-Y.
Herbie? Oh, it's just Herbie, you know, like E is a thing appertaining to a cellar is called celery. So a herbie is appertaining to a herb. Herbaceous.
Yes, that's near enough.
Herb-like.
Yes, herb-like is one of the two meanings of the nature of a herb, or it could be abounding in herbs, which your herbaceous brought it may, I don't know. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then I want the two women members of the team to study their quotations, and at the end of the program, I shall ask them where those quotations come from. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, here's your quotation. And so to bed. And Nancy Spain and Dennis Norton, your quotation is, there is a happy land far, far away. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written, and I don't want any of these answers now. Well, round two is the reason why department. 3 marks for a correct answer, though I may give some for originality if the accuracy is lacking. Dennis Powell, why, in the novel Lorna Doone, is there a feud between the Doone family and the hero, John Ridd?
Otherwise there wouldn't be any plot.
So on those family things, somebody must have killed somebody.
Yes.
Wait a minute, now the hero, Jan Ridd was the hero.
Yes.
Jan Ridd was the hero, and he did for the lot in the end. Carver Doone went down in a swamp.
Yes. A lot later.
I think he must have sort of, the Doones must have done for his father.
That's absolutely right. The Doone family murdered John Ridd's father, as far as I remember, in the first chapter.
Oh, got rid of him.
They Doone him.
And so it went on throughout the book.
That's a thigh slapper.
A thigh slapper.
All right, your turn, Dennis Norton. Why did the tortoise win the race against the hare?
Why did the tortoise? Because it reached the finishing line before the hare did.
It did. Could you expand a bit?
I could. I remember the hare sat down on its scut. Somewhere in the middle of the race. Actually, it's very misleading, isn't it, this thing? Because it's sort of slow and steady wins the race. providing that the strong and the swift give up halfway. Not providing that they take part in the race. In which case, you haven't a chance.
It's a case of hibitude.
Hibitude. Life is 6-4 against.
Yes. Well, I've got the bit about the hare sitting down, but it goes a little further than that, I think, Dennis.
Well, the tortoise went further than that.
Yes,
the
tortoise went
further. Yeah. And the tortoise didn't sit down.
Two out of three, because you've missed the one essential point, that the hare not only sat down, but fell asleep. Nancy Spade, we know that Rip Van Winkle walked off into the mountains and fell asleep. He also fell asleep and woke up 20 years later. But why did he walk off into the mountains in the first place?
Quarrelled.
With whom?
His wife.
Yes, absolutely right. 3 marks. She was a nagging shrew, and he couldn't stand it any longer, went off, and came back 20 years later. Moral there somewhere. Frank Muir, why did Caesar mistrust Cassius?
Ah, yes. Ah, well, you've got to be put into picture first, you see. You see, it opens with all these chaps, centre stage, slightly downstage, L. And there's carpenters and shoemakers, and they all jolly around and say lines and go off. Ah. Then another lot of people come in, the soothsayer comes on and says, sooth. And then they go off. And then the conspirators, Decius and Cascara and Cassius and Brutus and others too humorous to mention, they mill about vaguely, bottom, and then the Caesar enters. Caesar and his retinue enter. I can't remember the name of the retinue, because they never give it.
No.
Probably villagers and others. And they advance downstage, and then Caesar says to his retinue, he says, let me have about me men that are fat, sleek-headed men, such as sleep o' nights. Yon Cassius hath a lean and hungry look. Yond Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much, such men are dangerous.
Absolutely right.
Well, I got there. Well, there's your answer.
That's most of the play also in a nutshell. Well done. 3 marks.
It's rather large nut. Isn't it?
Well, the next round concerns verse and poetry. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it. Give me the next line or two. 2 marks if they can complete the quotation, and 2 more for correctly naming its source. Phyllis Bow, they stole little Bridget for 7 years long. When she came down again, her friends were all gone.
Little Bridget? It's a nursery rhyme, is it?
No, it isn't a nursery rhyme.
It's not a nursery rhyme. I've never heard it before.
It's by a chap called William Allingham, a poem called The Fairies, which begins up the Airy Mountain down the Rushy Glen. We don't go hunting for fair of little men. And about stanza 4 or 5, I think. They stole little Bridget for 7 years long. When she came down again, her friends were all gone. They took her lightly back between the night and the morrow. They thought that she was fast asleep, but she was dead with sorrow. Dennis Norton, very different this. I intended an ode, and it turned to a sonnet. It began a la mode. I intended an ode.
The Maud crossed the road in her Easter new bonnet. I intended an ode, but it turned to a sonnet.
It's as though I heard a voice saying, but Maud crossed the road. Wait, I hear that voice again.
In her Easter new bonnet.
In her Easter new bonnet.
I intended an ode, but it turned into a sonnet.
I intended an ode, but it turned into a sonnet.
It's a famous triolet.
It's a famous
triolet. I'd like another name rather than Maud, just to get it right.
Well, it can't be George.
Rose, I suppose. Rose.
Yes.
Oh, Rose Crossroad.
Rose, that's it. Rose Crossroad. Do you know who wrote it?
Jack, I will be honest.
It's a famous writer.
In the whole of my life, I have never heard this.
Oh, he's a famous old triolet.
He's a triolet writer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yes, I'll give him
a there's not much of a living in that.
Oh, well, he was the poet laureate, but I've forgotten.
Yes,
the poet laureate.
Poet laureate, yeah, you know.
Ah. Dobson.
Yes. You've fought your way through to 4 marks. You get 4 marks. It's Henry Austin Dobson, who was, as you say, poet laureate, a triolet, Rose Leaves, I think it's called, which was taken in different ways. And it runs, I intended an ode, and it turned to a sonnet. It began, a la mode, I intended an ode, but Rose crossed the road in her latest new bonnet. I intended an ode, and it turned to a sonnet. Now, Nancy Spain, bid me to live, and I will live, thy Protestant to be.
Well, Herrick.
Yes.
Bid me die.
No, not yet.
No. Oh, all right.
That comes later. 2 marks, I think. It is Robert Herrick, to Anthea, who may command him anything, bid me to live and I will live, thy Protestant to be, or bid me love and I will give a loving heart to thee. He goes on to die later on, but that's...
I'm sure, yeah.
Several bits all later.
All that hair.
Now, Frank Noah. Hark where my blossomed pear tree in the hedge leans to the field and scatters on the clover...
Oh, to be in April.
Yes.
It is, yes.
Oh, to be in Browning, now that April's here. This is the wise thrush who sings his song...
Yes.
Twice over.
Mm-hmm. In case you think he never could recapture that first fine, careless rapture. It's quite an effort for a swallow to sing. It's Browning, Robert Browning.
Yes.
Home Thoughts. From abroad.
Well done. 4 marks. And it goes, just to get this quote right, hark where my blossomed pear tree in the hedge leans to the field and scatters on the clover blossoms and dewdrops. At the bent spray's edge, that's the wise thrush. He sings each song twice over, lest you should think he never could recapture the first fine, careless rapture. Home Thoughts from abroad. Well, the next round is about origins and derivations, and it's always pretty hard to mark, but a maximum of 3 marks if I think they've deserved it. Dennis Powell, you begin. Penicillin.
Well, illin is a kind of scientific termination. It's a kind of fungus.
Yes. I'll give you another mark if you say who discovered it.
Oh, Fleming.
Yes. Antibiotic, first discovered in mould, and the culture under the microscope looked like thousands of tiny microscopic little pencils. And that's the name for the mould, penicillium, and hence penicillin for the drug. Originally, they weren't pencils, they were little paintbrushes, because the Romans didn't have any pencils, but that perhaps doesn't matter. 2 out of 3. Dennis Norden. Gout.
Gout is an illness. Its origin... I always thought it was port. gout. What, the word? The origin?
Yes.
Well, French, actually. Yes, the French are saying that everybody has gout, or chacun a son, as they say, and that's what it comes from. It's a mistranslation.
You've got to add another T and E onto that, and it is French, so I'm helping you a bit.
Goutte. Is a drop.
Yes.
In French. Everybody has a drop.
Lands yes. on the big toe joint.
Yes, yeah. And the results go.
Well, I think, again, 2 out of 3 for sheer ingenuity. A disease of the small joints, particularly of the big toe, which is very painful. It comes from the word meaning a drop in French because in medieval medicine, they thought it was caused by drops of acrid matter getting into the joints.
It is.
Nancy Spade. To go through the mill.
Means that you've had a terrible time
mm-hmm.
and emerged better than the others. You get ground down to a pulp and you're better.
Mm. I don't know why you're better.
You're better? Well, aren't you?
Different.
Well, yes, transformed.
The
husks have gone one way, the millstone's round your neck. What do you want me to say, Jack?
I think 2 out of 3 again. To suffer, either physically or metaphorically, grain going through the mill and being ground to powder or to flour, it's also a very old form of children's game if one of the children had been nasty to the other ones, where you had a row of children who leant up against a wall, making a kind of tunnel, and put the palms of their hands flat against the wall, and the wretched child had to run through 4 times, and he got 4 kinds of ill treatment. Rain first, which is a good slap. Lightning the second time, which is a rabbit punch. A 3rd time, thunder, which is a prod with the knee, which sounds horrible. And the last time, hailstones, which is a sharp punch in the back.
And there speaks the director of education.
Oh, yes, we do it every day. All right, back to Frank Muir. A man with no scruples.
A man with no scruples is unprincipled.
Yes.
That's the meaning.
Yes.
That's me one. A scruple is a tiny, weeny little apothecary's measure.
Yes.
It's a little sort of brass leaf bent, and you have to pick it up with tweezers.
Absolutely right, yes. A man without moral principles, you're quite right about that, and you're right about the apothecary's weight, 20 grains, a very tiny
weight.
Well,
it's 2 out of 3, isn't it?
So, a scruple, metaphorically, was a slight hesitation or doubt as to whether what you were just about to do was moral or honest, but very tiny. A man with no scruples at all had none. And now we come to the last round and go back to the two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Lewis Powell, I'd like the origin of your quotation, and so to bed.
Samuel Pepys.
Samuel Pepys's diary. It ends the chronicles of various days, well or ill spent. Nancy Spain, the origin of your quotation, which was, "There is a happy land far, far away."
It's a hymn.
Yes?
By somebody called Andrew Young.
Well done. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the larger or longer amount of applause from the audience here in the studio. So, back to Frank Muir and his quotation, "And so to bed."
"And so to bed." "Oh, botheration!" exclaimed Anne Kennington, her pretty face puckering into a moo of vexation. She had come to the end of her book. Her lovely book, The Conquest of Everest. She let it slip from her slim artistic fingers with a plonk onto the carpet. How she loved reading of Tibet. Tibet, where Daddy was. Anne got up and examined her face carefully in the old mirror. Below was a slim figure. She threw on an old pair of shoes, an old sweater, and made for the village. And she got to the clearing, and there by the old cottage, she pulled up with a jerk. There was Blair Tremaine. "Anne," he breathed. She smiled at him, and she flitted past and into his cottage. As ever, the scene inside brought a catch to her throat. He lived alone, Blair. It was an ordinary, humble bachelor's, a poor dwelling. There was a gumboot full of porridge. There was the old-fashioned wooden mangle he used for getting the last of the toothpaste out of his tube. Suddenly she heard a noise, and there was Blair towering over her. He folded her in his arms twice. He had very long arms. He hugged her to him, and her face was buried in the deep, spaniel-smelling tweed of his jacket. Anne, he gasped throatily. He was a man of few words. But those he knew, he worked hard. He said, "Anne, I want you to marry me. I've always loved you, and I think you love me." And she rather thought she did. But a tinge of carmine mantled her ear. And she ran past him, ran out into the woods where there was freedom, and she had time to think. Suddenly there was a honk, a purr of powerful exhausts, and there was Roddy Fox Carfax in his fast red sports car. He was terribly good-looking. He switched off the ignition, spun the wheel negligently until the wheels were pointing straight ahead, and sat there for a moment, cleaning his nails with a folded £5 note. But he was somehow almost too good-looking. There was something almost feminine in his pink cheeks and his carefully combed hair. With a sudden gesture, he folded the £5 note, put it in his handbag, and put the handbag in the glove compartment of the car. He said, "Anne, I want you to marry me. As you know, Father left me £1 million. I'm hoping to make it 2 million. You see, I'm going to Tibet tomorrow, Anne. I want you to come with me as my wife. I'm opening a holiday camp there on a plateau." She said, "I must have time. I must have time, please, Roddy."
And she ran away, and all that day she ran. It seemed to me sometimes she was in fields. One time she was in Grosvenor Crescent, Bognor Regis. But eventually when night came, she found her way back to her cottage. And there were two bunches of flowers waiting for her. A bunch of crimson orchids. And it just said, "Please be mine, Ruddy Fox Carfax." And then there were three little daisies held together with fuse wire. And it said, "Be my love, Blair." Which was she to choose? When she woke up on her honeymoon, did she look out of the window, did Anne look out of the window and see the palaces and the distant Himalayas of Tibet? And did she see the face of her millionaire husband? Or did she see a gumboot of porridge and the face of the man she really loved? Oi, I think we all know in our heart of hearts what her choice was. When she woke up and saw Tibet.
After that heartless story, I'm going to turn to Dennis Norden and remind you that his quotation was, "There is a happier land far, far away."
I was musing in my flat the other day. I have a muse flat, actually. And I got to thinking. You know the way you do sometimes when the television's broken? There's nothing so pathetic as a fallen star. Now, this thought was occasioned by the fact that that morning I'd had a new charlady. I'd had to get rid of the old charlady because of something that happened with Venetian blinds. I have had Venetian blinds in my front room, and she'd taken it into her head to clean them by putting them in the washing machine. I don't know if anybody would be interested in buying 9,713 toothpicks. But she had to go. And she went. And I sent to the local slave market for another charlady. And they sent this woman, Mrs. Haviland, who was very nice, decent, responsible sort of person, rather different from the usual type of charlady. For one thing, she turned up wearing white elbow-length gloves and a pink chiffon evening dress with silver shoes. And I said to her, "You seem a very superior sort of person to be engaged in this menial chore." "Kindly," I said. And she looked up, and there was a tear in her eyes, and it was only then that I recognized whom she was none other than. Do you know who she was none other than? She was none other than Teresa Haviland, of Jeffrey and Teresa Haviland. Three times winners of the South Middlesex Ballroom Dancing Championships. And she told me her story, which I found very affecting. You won't, because you don't look that sort of person, but I did. You remember Jeffrey and Teresa Haviland, Mr. and Mrs. Slow Foxtrot, king and queen of the ballroom, who had reigned undisputed champion three times, until suddenly the taste of the public changed. All the public wanted was Latin American dances. And Jeffrey couldn't do the cha-cha. He found himself in the same dilemma as some of the best minds of our time. Too old for the cha-cha and too young for old-time dancing. She had to descend to scrubbing in order to support them both. I was appalled. I said to her, "But can you do the cha-cha?" So she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, why don't you teach Jeffrey how to do it?" For the first time, a gleam of hope came into her eye. "Do you think I could?" I said, "Of course you could. Stick at it. You just cha-cha away with him. He'll learn it." Her face lit up. She said, yes, yes. Perhaps I could even make use of this menial experience I've had. I could describe myself as the cha-cha-cha. Well, I must admit I would like to make it a happy ending, but I have never heard of them since. But I would like to think that somewhere in some small room, Teresa is teaching Geoffrey, pounding away at the steps of the cha-cha while some little battered gramophone plays T for Two or Patricia. I just hope so, that's all. Wherever you are, Mrs. Haviland, keep at it. Teresa Haviland, cha-cha away.
Oh, well, that was an affecting one that time. Your marking is very hard to distinguish. You gave about the same amount of applause to both. I think I should have to make that a tie between Frank Muir and Dennis Norden. And that brings us to a final mark in which Dennis Powell and Frank Muir just win by one mark from Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.